I call this meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, please take your seats. Thank you, Representative Lilly. There is a quorum present, and I wanted to know if there would be somebody who would make the motion to approve the minutes for February 5th, 2019.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the minutes for the February 5th, 2019 meeting.
Representative Wolgamott moves to approve the minutes for February 5th, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 5th, 2019 are approved. Okay, so today we have an exciting day, learning more from our universities on, or our university, but which is made up of universities. So that is okay to say that, I guess. But we have allocated the most of the time. Roughly a certain amount of minutes, it says on here, and it's like all the minutes. But our goal will be to end by 4 o'clock today. So today we have a presentation from Minnesota State who will be introducing their budget request. We have several presenters today, starting with Chancellor Malhotra. And welcome back to our committee. Come on up, and you may proceed. And do you want your presenters to join you all at once, or as... How do you want to handle that? Because you've got amazing presenters. We can have them all. We could get enough chairs to have them all up at the same time. You decide.
Sure. Chair Benardi, my script says they come in a little while.
Okay.
So I think I'll stick to my script.
Okay.
Otherwise, I can get into trouble with my staff.
Right. Okay. Excellent. I like that you have a plan. That is good. So, Chancellor, you may proceed.
Thank you. Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, for the record, I am Devendra Malhotra. I have the privilege and honor to serve as the Chancellor for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Joining me today is Trustee Coles. He's the Vice Chair of our Board of Trustees. He's in the audience today. Thank you, Trustee Coles. And also, I'm told on the way is Trustee Dawn Erlinson, and so she may join us also a little later. I would also like to recognize some of our presidents who are in the audience today. President Millander of Century College, President Arthur from Metropolitan State University, President McDonald from North Hennepin Community College, President Wacker from St. Cloud State University, and President Olson from Winona State University. And I also noticed when I came in that there were quite a few of our faculty members also in the audience, and it's a delight and honor to have them in the audience too. I want to recognize two other colleagues who would also be here to, who are also here today: Vice Chancellor of Finance Laura King, and Vice Chancellor of Information Technology Ramon Padilla. You'll hear from them a little later. We are delighted to be with the committee again. Last time, we gave you an overview presentation of our mission, vision, and our goals, and we are grateful for the time you have allotted to us today for our budget request. We're also grateful for the time the committee spent learning more about Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, an institution which has a unique and a special place in the Minnesota state system. The students of Fond du Lac represent just a microcosm of the students we serve across the system in all our colleges and universities. You may recall from our last presentation that who we are is really defined by a couple of salient facts, and that is we serve close to 375,000 students across the state, both in credit and non-credit bearing activities. And of them, more than 65,000 students of color and of native origin. More than 75,000 students are low-income students. More than 80,000 students are 25 years and older. more than 43,000 are first in their family to go to college, 10,000 veterans and service members, and 118,000 employees in business and industry who get training from us through our customized training and continuing education program. These numbers are testament to our commitment to affordability, to both enhanced access and enhanced support for historically underserved students. In order to live into our full potential and promise, every one of us at Minnesota State is focused on three guiding principles. That is, the success of our students. That is, we not only provide enhanced access, but we also see them across the finish line. Diversity, equity, and inclusion is our second guiding priority. And then the third one is financial and programmatic sustainability of our institutions. Today I plan to provide you with an overview of budget request. Then Vice Chancellor Padilla and Presidents Melander and Olson will do a deeper dive into our technology request, describing the challenges we face in that area and how we intend to solve that challenge with the help from all of you. Presidents McDonald and Arthur will describe the budget impact our campuses are feeling and bring to life what is described in our legislative request book, which we have shared with you already. Finally, I'll be joined by Vice Chancellor King, who will provide the committee with a history of funding for the system, national trends, and will provide more detail about our budget request before you, and would also be able to answer any questions you have on the specific details of our budget request. Even though you've allotted us all your time, going from last time, we had intended to keep our testimony brief, enough so that we have an opportunity for all of you to ask any questions you may have regarding our request. We much rather talk about things you want us to talk about rather than what we have on our own minds. If there is one thing about our request that I hope you will take away today, it is that it's not just about doing business as usual on our campuses. It is 100% aligned with our commitment to communities across Minnesota, and more specifically with our commitment to affordability and enhanced access and support to historically underserved communities. Communities need Minnesota now more than ever. Minnesota State, I should say. Communities need Minnesota State now more than ever, and we need your support to meet their expectations and aspirations. I firmly believe that our budget request outlined on page 3 of the legislative request book in front of you reflects what we have heard from you and your communities. It also reflects what we need to effectively serve all communities across the state. In the coming months, as you consider our request, please know we are well aware that our request would be a heavy lift for you. However, I like to think of it as a thoughtful request that accurately reflects all we heard again and again from our students and our community partners across the state. The workforce challenge that business and industry face across the state is enormous. Our request represents what is needed so that we can effectively serve our students, fill the workforce gap, and continue to be a catalyst for economic and social vibrancy of throughout Minnesota. Investing in our campuses, students, and communities is an investment in Minnesota. I would like to break down our request into four components, beginning with how important it is to fund our inflation request at our colleges and universities. In a few minutes, President McDonald and President Arthur will describe their experience dealing with financial sustainability on a campus, something President Bill Mackey from the Northeast Higher Education District spoke with you a few days ago when we were here to talk about our mission. You will begin to hear the chorus that repeats the same message. If we don't partner together to support the financial health of every campus, access and affordability will be at risk at all campuses. We simply cannot continue to disinvest in higher education without there being consequences. Consequences to our mission, vision, goals, and the three priorities I mentioned a few moments ago. Many of you have heard us speak of our technology request, or what we refer fondly as Next Gen. I would like to thank you for the $4 million annual investment you have already made in Next Gen. Vice Chancellor Padilla and Presidents Olson and Melander will go into greater detail about this critical need, but I want to reiterate just how important that investment is. We are currently operating with a system called ISRS. It's a 20-year-old, outdated system that has reached the end of its service life and is simply not equipped to take us where we need to be in order to serve and support our students. Our colleges and universities process more than 100,000 financial transactions every day. 400,000 people, including every faculty member, staff member, and student, access the system are reliant on ISRS. Mm-hmm. However, it has run its course, and we need to move to a more cost-effective and upgraded technology infrastructure. We are ready to work with you to meet the current and future needs of our students, but we need your help to strengthen access to help our students advance and succeed. This is why we are proposing two new grant programs. The first, directed at our two-year college students, will help support those with the greatest financial need and help them get across the finish line. The second grant program is targeted at students transferring from a Minnesota State College to a university and is intended to encourage progression from associate degree to bachelor's degree. Vice Chancellor Laura King will say more about these proposals in a few moments. I want to be clear that we share your passion for career and technical education. Each year, close to 20,000 students graduate from our two-year career and technical programs. The last time I was before the committee, I briefly described the partnership tour I took last year across the state. I'm very grateful for those of you around the table who were able to join me at one venue or the other. Thank you. We visited 22 communities to listen to what legislators, business leaders, community leaders, members of the K-12 sector, and nonprofit leaders had to say about the partnerships our system and our campuses have forged. I witnessed firsthand how important those graduates are to the communities you represent. We have heard a simple message repeated in every community, in every corner of the state. They need us, and more importantly, they need us to do more. That is because we are the partner of choice across Minnesota. With the $15 million we are requesting for career and technical education, we'll be able to address workforce needs through innovative career and technical and professional programming that serves business and industry, as well as expand career and technical education and professional programming in sectors with high employment growth. We believe it's critical to strengthen and expand the K-12 career and technical pipeline and grow K-12 collaborative programming and develop new teacher education pathways. It is imperative that Minnesota State enhance access and support the underserved students and make sure we are meeting those needs. Chair Bernardi, with your permission, I would like to turn the presentation over to Vice Chancellor Padilla, President Melander, and President Olson, who will take you through our technology request. Okay. Chair Bernardi and members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chancellor Malhotra. I think I said it better the second time, didn't I?
Yes.
Malhotra?
Okay. That was fine. You can call me by any name.
Okay.
I'm just interested in the money.
Chancellor's easiest, but I'm getting it.
Thank you.
Okay. And is Vice Chancellor Padilla starting?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Bernardi. My name is Ramon Padilla. I'm Vice Chancellor for IT for Minnesota State. And we're here to talk about our technology request today. But before we talk about the future, I'd like to talk about our current state, which is ISRS. ISRS is comprised of our financial, accounting, human resource, and student information system that essentially allows all of our colleges and universities to conduct business. It plays a critical role in the success of our students from application to graduate and every process in between. It serves as the cornerstone data system for our enterprises and requires high security and high availability. It touches everyone and nearly every activity, application, registration, course scheduling, housing, financial aid, transcripts, system finance, accounting, and HR. But it's 20 years old, it's homegrown, and it's reached the end of its technological life. We've been good stewards of the state by creating and maintaining ISRS for 20 years. But now the system prevents our campuses from being competitive and puts the system in technological risk. Our board is committed to managing the risk of the current 20-year-old system by moving forward with this project with your continued support. The time to act is now before we have a crisis. You will see that it is expected to take several years to do this right, and we need your support to do it. Scott?
Okay, President Scott Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thanks to you and thanks to everybody on this committee for your service to Minnesota and for your commitment to helping us serve our students. We're really grateful for that. The whole Reimagining Minnesota State project you might have heard about is about us finding new and better ways to serve students. And this whole budget request you're going to hear today is about us finding new and better ways to serve our students. You have already helped us in this regard. You have already appropriated about $4 million to help us do this next-gen journey, and we're back here to you today to ask for further support and for us to paint a little bit of a picture of what it can mean to students. What this request would do, what NextGen does, is it puts into the hands of our students tools that will help them make better real-time future-oriented decisions about what they should be studying and where they're going with their lives and with their professions. We believe it's going to help shorten their time to graduation. There's a certain number of students who will always graduate with more than the minimally required number of credits because of choices along the way that maybe weren't quite the right choices and that require retaking something or redoing a semester. And putting these tools in the hands of students and faculty, we believe, will help shorten that time to graduation, and shortening time to graduation is also savings to students. So let me try to paint a picture of what it might be like. So right now we've got a lot of faculty in our system who have 60, 70 advisees, and they're trying to meet with them, and they're trying to give them good advice. But a lot of the time that's spent in those conversations is time around what course should I take? But if we put these next-gen tools in the hands of the student, these questions about, well, what course is next and what's offered next semester and how can I kind of get from where I am to where I want to go in the shortest possible time is all answered through technology-assisted advising, which is what underlies this kind of whole concept. So now the conversations that are going on between the faculty member and those students are conversations about what profession should I pursue? What should I do with my life? What kind of other things could I be doing outside of these studies that would enhance my journey toward my goals? That's a much richer, much more robust kind of conversation to be having, much better for the students, and because this technology puts in their hands this kind of robust, real-time, and by the way, ubiquitous everywhere, working on mobile devices, working on iPads, working on home computers, etc., it really puts a lot of power into the hands of students and into the hands of faculty who advise them. We think it means a quicker, more efficient, better path to graduation. We think it leads to better decision making. And I believe it would lead to direct savings to students and their families. So I think we have shared goals regarding this because it's about affordability, it's about student success, and it's about inclusion, which are goals I know we mutually share. We have behind me in the audience, I'm pleased to say, two members of Winona State's faculty are here, Kendall Larson. Where are you, Kendall? There's Kendall. And our Faculty Association President, Jenna Chernega, who's sitting there. And in conversation with them, I know they wish they could do the best possible advising for students, and I know they are supportive of this aspect of this proposal because of the tools that it puts in our hands. I can also tell you the Winona State Student Senate has voted and has also supported this, so our students are all for it too. So thank you for considering this aspect of our budget proposal, but thanks really abidingly and deeply and forever for your commitment to Minnesota and your commitment to our students. Vice Chancellor Padilla.
Thank you. In front of you is a depiction of our plan at a very high level of how we're going to move forward. You may be asking yourself, so what did this $4 million you gave us buy? And the answer to that question is phase one, our readiness and procurement phase. We've spent a considerable amount of time planning, last 2 years, in fact, or more, to make sure that when we get to the end, we're going to be extremely successful. We do not want to have a situation that would not be good. So we're going to work very hard to make sure it goes very well. You'll see that it doesn't take till the end of 2025 to actually see results. We have a four-phased approach. Finance will be the first phase to go forward, followed by HR, and then shortly after that, student. In case you're wondering, it's built on a pyramid this way because all those pieces kind of depend on each other. And the last phase is probably the most complicated phase, which is the student information system. And so we kind of build on our successes. And a key point on this chart and this is that green line, which is we are going to RFP this summer, and so we need to go forward with the funding plan so that we can procure the product that we wish to move forward with. And so we hope to make that decision this summer. Angelia?
Sure. Chair Bernardi, committee members,
just one
for
second.
The record.
Okay, welcome, President Millender, right?
Millender.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, and it was a pleasure visiting your campus this year, so thank you for having us. I just wanted to get it on the record, your name, and ask you to proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angelia Millender, and I am the president of Century College. The slide before you illustrates our phase one deliverables. We really are planning to plan for a successful implementation. As you read this slide, I want to emphasize all the well-developed, purposeful, and planned steps and all the efforts taken to achieve these outcomes. Please note that all of these deliverables are essential components and important to a successful implementation, along with everything shared by my colleagues. Prior to joining the Minnesota State College and University system, I worked for two large higher education systems where there was a need to modernize their enterprise systems with current technologies and redesign business process. I was very engaged in the same planning and implementation steps. I must share that based on these experiences and my work here, the Menn State system is delivering exceptional work. From visioning stage to defining our scope and putting our students at the center of this work. From ensuring clarity and transparency at all levels of the process to governance and business process mapping of the current and future states and including multiple stakeholders and content experts. All while managing the change that is so very critical to ensure that employees know the why and adapt accordingly to implement this project as intended with the expected timelines.
Thank you, President Melander.
Thank you. And Mr. Padilla.
Thank you. We'd like to end with this section by saying thank you very much for our time. We need to be strong and clear in the urgency of this work. We have a very old system, and you can't put a new one in overnight. So we have to begin as soon as possible. And we have a shared commitment in its successful execution. And before I leave the table, I'd like to introduce President McDonald from North Hennepin Community College, who will come to the table to speak to our request from a campus perspective.
Excellent. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, President McDonald. And I enjoyed visiting your campus this year as well. It was great to hear from the students, and I just recall the food insecurity that was talked about and the great needs that the students have. It was very informative.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to spend some time with you this afternoon. My name is Barbara McDonald, and I have the privilege and honor of serving as president of North Hennepin Community College. President Arthur from Metropolitan State University and I are here to share a story about each of our institutions. But having said that, there are many more examples of our outstanding colleges and universities located in your Minnesota State a legislative request booklet, and I would encourage you to flip through that booklet to really get a better understanding and a full picture of the impact of our sister institutions and universities across the state, both in greater Minnesota and also the metro area. Our mission at North Hennepin Community College is simply stated, engaging students and changing lives. We are located in one of the most diverse cities in the metropolitan area, Brooklyn Park, in the Northwest region. And our student body and increasingly our staff and faculty reflect this very rich diversity. We have very strong partnerships with the cities that were surrounding us, not only the city of Brooklyn Park, but Brooklyn Center, Osseo, Maple Grove, and beyond. And each year we work together intentionally to meet the needs of the citizens and the constituents we represent. As you can see from the North Hennepin slide in front of you, we serve over 10,000 students, most of whom attend our institution part-time. In fact, about 80% of our students attend part-time because they're also working one, two, sometimes three jobs in order to pursue their educational dreams. Nearly 48% of our students represent students of color in indigenous populations. Over half are first generation and receive grants or scholarship aid to support the cost of attendance. Many of our students come from immigrant populations and are new Americans, really representing the future face of our workforce. This is in stark contrast to when our doors first opened almost 50 years ago with 414 students in the top floor of the Osseo Junior High School in the middle of potato country. We've come a long way, and we are proud of the impact our institution has had within the communities we serve, with over $272.5 million in combined contributions and with regard to the economic impact we've had in 2017. North Hennepin plays a really critical role in meeting workforce demand. In fact, demand for labor has grown as the supply has diminished, as you're well aware of, and this is a real big challenge for us. There were over 142,000 job vacancies in Minnesota during the second quarter of 2018, and a 5.2% increase over last year, and 58% of these jobs are located in the metro area. If you visited any of our surrounding area around North Hennepin Community College and along the 610 corridor and adjacent communities, you'll see that this growth is really exponential. In fact, this year at a State of the Cities address, we heard from our mayors that they're expecting to fill over 6,000 jobs just in our surrounding area alone. Today, we are an essential community asset serving the quickly growing Northwest metro area with programs to meet this workforce demand. Our employers are demanding high-skilled workers, they want a diverse workforce, and they're expecting North Hennepin Community Colleges and our other institutions to deliver for them. And fundamentally, with frozen tuition and the annual cost of inflation, we need your support so we have the operating funds to help us do this work. This is what our financial sustainability is all about. Because our learners come to us with hopes and dreams of bettering their lives and the lives of their families and communities. I mentioned earlier that nearly 60% of our students are first generation and low income. And what does this mean? I'm sure you hear this a lot. What it means is that we need to be student-ready institutions that can address the many obstacles our new-to-higher education students face. They're first in their family to go to college, and our job is to help them navigate a very unfamiliar landscape and attain their education so they can be prepared to enter the workforce and drive our future economy. A primary challenge in meeting their goals is closing what we call the opportunity gap, which is the gap in success rates that we see at our institutions between our students of color and indigenous students and our Caucasian students. As we see our population continue to diversify, their needs diversify as well. We provide support services that are really critical to their success, such as courses that will allow them to learn English as a second language, developmental education, tutoring services, counseling and advising support, our food shelf, scholarships, access to community resources like SNAP and housing, and so on. A fully funded request will allow us to continue to meet these needs and keep our essential services operational. We have the talent to make these challenges become realities because of the unbelievable, amazing support and outstanding work of our faculty and staff. I'd like to dovetail a little bit on the conversation Chancellor Molcha had earlier about the operations with regard to ISRS, our Integrated Student Services System. You heard from President Olson about the ratio of advisors to students, and I can tell you at North Hennepin it's triple that, sometimes quadruple that, as advisors work with our students. And we're going to need an up-to-date technologically smart solution for our students so that they're able to take education into their own hands and be able to work more effectively and efficiently with their advisors. Not only that, but as you heard earlier, it's the backbone of our operations, and it's really essential to how we do business at the community college. Right now, it's on its last leg and not delivering the technology needed to keep our students on track. It's all about retention and success. What happens if we don't get funded? The college already operates on a very tight budget from year to year, and without essential funding to support our work, we'll have to make some difficult decisions such as cutting programs, eliminating services, and this will have a serious impact on our learners, on our ability to meet the workforce demands, and certainly will have an impact on jobs. In closing, I'd like to share a story with you some of you may be familiar with already. And this is a story about a student alum who was recognized at the Minnesota State Capitol last week as part of our Rotunda work. And I tell you this story because this student represents so many other students at North Hennepin. Behind him are hundreds just like him. Basil Ajou is a first-generation immigrant student. He earned an Associate of Science in Paralegal and Associate of Arts in Liberal Arts Education from North Hennepin Community College in 2016. However, his path to success was not easy, including being raised in poverty in Cameroon by his grandmother. In 2012, by the urging of his grandmother, who happened to be a retired elementary school teacher, and I might add that Bazile was one of 12 children, Bazile moved to the United States seeking both freedom and education. He overcame several barriers to attend North Hennepin, including transportation, a new language, and culture, that first-generation picture I painted earlier. While attending North Hennepin as a full-time student, Bazile worked two jobs, served as the president of North Hennepin's Black Men's Leadership Movement, and was vice president of the Student Senate. Through all of his involvement, he found his passion serving students from low-income backgrounds and disadvantaged families. He continued his education, and he's one of our star examples of our system working collaboratively. He transferred on to Metro State University, earning a bachelor's degree in individualized studies with a focus in political science and public advocacy in 2017, and is currently pursuing and completing his master's in advocacy and political leadership. His dream is to run for public office, of which he's already gained some experience by serving on the Minnesota State Board of Trustees. More importantly and more amazing is that Bazile was inspired by the generosity of others and by what he received at North Hennepin, and he's gone on to establish Minnesota Africans United and International Institute for Caring, both nonprofit organizations, serving underprivileged families and becoming self-sufficient. And this is just one example of an individual who is destined to lead. And without his start at North Hennepin Community College, none of this would have happened, and none of his future would be possible. He also exemplifies how our system works together to provide transfer pathways for student success. And as I said earlier, behind Bazile are hundreds of similar success stories that represent our future workforce and a working economy. So thank you for letting me share my story today, and I'll turn this over now to President Arthur.
Well, thank you very much, President McDonald. I just must say, I'm like, oh, that's who I'm planning to meet with. I met him recently, and we're trying to schedule a time. I'm like, that's him.
You'll enjoy meeting him. He has a lot of passion and energy.
Right. It's excellent. Thank you for your testimony. And President Arthur. Oh, do you... let's wait till after, because I do have a list started. Yep. Okay, thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Ginny Arthur, and I serve as the president of Metropolitan State University. I add my gratitude for this opportunity to speak with you today about the importance of this budget request to Metropolitan State and its sister universities and colleges. The slide you see in front of you is a snapshot of the information about Metro State that is excerpted from the legislative request booklet you have all received. Each of our seven universities has a page detailing what is at stake in this budget request for our campuses. As Minnesota's public urban university, recognized by the Carnegie Foundation as an engaged urban university for our long-standing commitment to learning in, with, and from the communities in which we are embedded, and yes, we are located throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area, we, like our system as a whole, serve an increasingly culturally, linguistically, and racially diverse population. You will see on the slide that more than 43% of our students are students of color or American Indian. The breakdown for those who began their studies at the university this year is close to 50%. Two-thirds of our students are from low-income families, first in their family to attend college, or students of color or American Indian. Characteristics that not always, but generally, do put them at risk unless we provide additional academic and social supports. On the basis of the number of Hmong and Southeast Asian students we serve, Metro State is now officially designated by the U.S. Department of Education as a minority-serving institution. And CollegeNet, an organization which computes a social mobility index for universities across the nation, places Metro State as number 21 out of nearly 1,400 universities on the list, the top 1.52%. I like precision. All seven of Minnesota State universities fall in the upper 60% of this ranking. I believe it's this fact that as state universities and colleges, we educate students from low-income families and propel them into the middle class, which is most important to our state and most in jeopardy without increased investment. I think all of you know the pain of grappling with inadequate financial resources. So I want to tell you a little bit about what your increased investment in your universities can and will do. We will develop and grow quality academic programs, which are in high demand by the state's employers. You heard from President McDonald the statistics about what our businesses are facing. Those fields will include things like cybersecurity. I think I hardly need to comment on the urgency of educating practitioners in this field. And currently in the state of Minnesota, there are about 15 jobs for every graduate. Data science, a field permeating every aspect of modern decision making, from medicine to policy to commerce. Biology, chemistry, and biochemistry, backbone fields for Minnesota's science-based industries. Environmental sciences, we're having a lot of talk about the environment these days. Nursing, at both the baccalaureate and doctoral practice levels. Advanced dental therapy, a new and growing profession which can help alleviate oral health care practitioner shortages in both rural Minnesota and the urban core. Urban teacher preparation, a program in which 50% of our teacher candidates are students of color or American Indian. This is a point where we know we need those teachers to help us close that opportunity gap at the K-12 level. And in social work, we have the most diverse program in the state. And if the university could open a master's degree in social work tomorrow, it would be filled with talented, diverse students next month. Our students are in demand because of the cultural competency that they bring to the workplace. We need resources to expand opportunities and leverage the academic assets across all our universities and colleges as we work to develop a statewide collaborative network for assessment of prior learning, an evidence-based practice which promotes adult degree completion and is particularly important to our veteran students. To promote learning and degree completion, we often need to support our students with scholarships, emergency grants to fix the car or pay the rent, and a food and clothing pantry. At Metropolitan State, we just added a social worker to our student success team so that we can connect students to community resources to alleviate their food, housing, transportation, and child care insecurities. Much of what presents as mental illness is really extreme stress from just trying to survive and get an education. I want to end my remarks by passing a thank you along that I received from an alumnus just this morning. This is a Somali immigrant who got a degree at Metropolitan State and now has a significant managerial role in a large property management firm in the Twin Cities. His words for me: my university education saved me. It saved my family. I want to thank you for making it possible for us at Minnesota State to make that kind of difference for people and their community every day. There is so much more we can do with your partnership. Now, with the permission of Chair Bernardi, President McDonald and I will turn the mic over to Vice Chancellor Laura King. Thank you.
Thank you very much, President Arthur. I want to invite Laura King, the Vice Chancellor of Finance, down to testify. And if our if people who testify today could like sit in the front row, and you might all already be there, we will be able. We have a number of questions, and we can call upon the people to answer those questions when needed. Welcome to the committee, Ms. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm delighted to be here. I feel like I'm sitting on that, what's that fairy tale about being on top of a pile of mattresses? I feel kind of tall here. Pardon me one second. There. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon. If I could, before I dive into the details of the budget request, I'd like to just provide the committee with a little bit of background information about the financial profile of our colleges and universities. You've heard terrific testimony from our presidential colleagues about the student profile, and I'd like to match that with some information on the finance side. As the chancellor has already mentioned, Minnesota is in a very competitive environment for talented citizens and labor force participants. As the Minnesota's job market has remained strong, FYE enrollment is expected to be 2.2% lower than it was in fiscal year 2019, excuse me, in 19 than it was in 18. This trend began as the state recovered from the recession following fiscal year 2011. Our colleges and universities managed explosive growth from 2006 to 2011, growing nearly 18% in enrollment. Since then, enrollment has slowed down, and 2019 is projected to be 6% below 2006 levels. They handled that growth and the decline without any state assistance. We are not funded on the basis of enrollment. In fact, our state support has historically been reduced as enrollment increases occur during recessions. The strong economy and demographic dips in the number of high school students continues to negatively impact our enrollment. For decades, who's got the driver? Pardon me while we have a little technical adjustment. Oh, all right, super, thank you. For decades, Minnesota invested in that competitive environment through its investment in public higher education. While we continue to have one of the highest ratios of college graduates in the country, that generation is approaching and entering retirement, and we are not investing at the same levels in the next generation. In 1997, Minnesota's per FYE funding for public higher education was 11% higher than the national average. Between 1995 and 2015, Minnesota's investment per FYE declined at more than twice the decline in the national rates, a decline of 31% versus 13%. As of 2017, we are now 11% below the national average. Another measure compares the state's public aid per FYE to the national average, and on that measure, Minnesota invested less than the national average in 2017, and 21 states invested more than the national average. We have looked at our total revenue per FYE, including both tuition and your support, and find that revenue to our colleges and universities adjusted for inflation has increased at the rate of 0.1% per year. During that period, state support declined over $700 per FYE, a decline of 15%. Investments at that level will not enable us to continue to support Minnesota's economic competitive environment, and we need your help. Committee members are aware of recent increases in funding for our colleges and universities, and we are grateful for that support. I see Representative Nornes here, and we are grateful for the leadership he's provided to this system over the years. As you can see on slide 18, inflation, however, has not been our friend. The blue bars, which represent nominal state funding levels, have moved with the state's economy. As the state budget has sagged, so too have our funding levels. The long-term trend downward that's reflected in the blue line illustrates what inflation does to our ability to finance our college and universities
and their work with students. That decline began in the 80s as the state budget expanded, and it has continued up and down through the state's budget process in these 20 years. President McDonald and Arthur and all of our presidents and campuses have been living the reality on this slide. We have seen state appropriations increase and tuition reliance decrease, but it's key to recognize that the two revenue sources for us work together to provide our colleges and universities with over 90% of their total revenue. With state funds in recent years substituting for tuition revenue, while state funding levels have increased, our college and university revenues have not. We have averaged a 1% per year increase in revenue over these past 10 years without adjusting for inflation. Adjusting that revenue growth for inflation drops that average to almost unmeasurable 0.1%. So we have reduced programs and budgets every year to balance out the equation. The challenge on campuses has been made harder in the last two biennia due to the structure of appropriated funds provided through the budget process. In 2019, we reported a structural gap at the start of 2020 of $26 million. Note our ongoing appropriation decrease from fiscal 18 to fiscal 19 by $10 million. That creates for us a structural gap in our college and university budgets. Our budget request before you today comes from our community. Conversations across our colleges and universities with all our constituent groups started last April, and our request brings forward the themes and interests we heard from our student associations, from our presidents, from our faculty and classified labor unions, from our community conversations. First, that we should tell you what we need to do the work we think you expect us to do. We should seek to protect the services we provide to students and to our communities. We should continue our work to address the racial and economic disparities that are present in our communities, and we should continue efforts to move the state back toward its historic funding levels. Once the budget process completes, we have an internal allocation process, and I thought I'd take a second on this one just because with new members there might not be awareness of what happens in the smoke after the bills are done. At the conclusion of the session, the campus support resources will flow into something that we call the allocation framework. This is an internal distribution process we use. It's a data-driven framework that recognizes differences in program costs and mission among our colleges and universities. Revenue generated on the campus stays on the campus. As hard as I've tried to pass tuition revenue through St. Paul so I can take a little clip off of it, I've never been successful at that. Tuition revenue is collected on the campus and then stays there. This allocation framework has oversight by the Leadership Council and the board. It was first implemented over 10 years ago now, and after a 14-month committee process reviewing it, it was revised in 2016. Of the state support available to us this year in 2019, 88% of it is distributed to the colleges and universities through the allocation framework. 6% is kept in St. Paul and pays bills on behalf of all the colleges and universities, like our system debt service bill, like the bill we pay to the Attorney General's office, and the balance, or $33 million, supports the system office. The size and scope of the system office has been occasionally arisen as a topic of some interest. The system office is supported by state appropriation grants and some modest earned income. There's no tuition revenue in the system office, and of course there are no students in the system office. The system office budget is about 40% technology related, because as you heard from Vice Chancellor Padilla, we run an enterprise system on behalf of all 375,000 students and all 17,000 employees. And so there's a budget associated with doing that. That's about 40% of the system office budget. And then the balance pays for legal services, financial reporting, construction management, federal grant management, all services that are provided either collectively or individually to colleges and universities. Overall, the system office budget's down 15% from 2011 to 2017. It was specified in law in 2010, effective with 2012, and that number has not increased since then. It relates in terms of, you know, if you think about $33 million in our overall budget, it's about 2% of the system's entire budget, funded entirely with state appropriation. The internal allocation process provides that the campuses receive a block grant. It is sent out after action by the board in block grant form. The president establishes the line item budget and makes all of the spending decisions. There's no direction from St. Paul as to how many faculty or how many advisors or how much to provide for building maintenance. It's a block grant to the presidents, and then they establish their local priorities. It's a single allocation. Presidents have authority to make all their budget decisions, and we think it works best that way. The presidents are best positioned to make investment choices in their communities. As I mentioned, our colleges and universities are highly dependent on state appropriation and tuition. I like to say we're a very simple operation. We don't have medical schools. We don't have law schools. We don't have big national research operations. State appropriation and tuition for our system in 2019 was about $1.5 billion. And so you can see on this slide, we watch this relationship very closely. Recent strong state funding awards and flat tuition rates have turned the trend on this slide. This is the chart that relates to the one-third, two-thirds narrative that you might hear about. That refers to the aspirational language that's in statute. That would have the state supporting two-thirds of the cost of a person's education and the individual supporting one-third to tuition. You can see that we're a long way from that, although there's been great improvement with your help over the last several biennia. If our request is fully funded, this relationship would be approximately 54% state appropriation, 46% tuition by the end of the next biennium, an improvement of nearly 5% in this relationship in the next 2 years. Our requests ask the state for support sufficient to replace the revenue we would earn with a 3% undergraduate tuition increase, which is about $67 million over the biennium. Compensation costs for us, as you heard from the Chancellor, are about $169 million over the biennium. And if both the tuition increase and the compensation increase are combined, we would then be in a position to provide balanced budgets with reasonable resource additions to the colleges and universities. We have faced negotiations with the legislature concerning tuition since 2013, and it's important to remind ourselves of the revenue pressures our campuses face. College tuition rates in 2019 will be the same as they were in 2014. University rates have increased twice in the past 6 years. State funding levels plus tuition revenues provides the budget resources, and any gap then results in either reallocations or absolute budget reductions. So you can see our colleges and universities have a very hard hand. Both revenues and expenses are strongly influenced by others and highly unpredictable. Regulatory and compliance costs increase every year, as does the desire for stronger student services and campus life programs. We reallocate both to cut budgets and to direct resources from lower priorities to higher priorities. Over the past 9 years, our colleges and universities have reallocated on average about $35 million a year. In just the past 4 years, they've reallocated a total of $146 million. Including $92 million in absolute budget reductions. These cuts have eliminated jobs, closed programs, slowed technology and equipment replacement, and just in the past 5 years resulted in the reduction in the number of system employees by 1,800 people, a reduction of about 10% in total headcount. We entered 2019 with a $36 million structural gap.
And so our colleges and universities, as you can see on this table, are facing continued financial pressure to meet the demands from the community and balance their budgets. You've heard about the campus support request from the Chancellor and the NextGen request from Vice Chancellor Padilla. You've heard from our presidents about college operations. I would like to spend just a few minutes on our strategic investments request and then invite the Chancellor back into the conversation. We're very focused on improving student persistence and success and have executed multiple strategies across our campuses. With your help, several years ago, we launched a workforce grant program targeting certain educational paths. We'd like to expand that idea this year with two grant programs tied directly to our commitment to serve low-income students and increase the rate of baccalaureate attainment across the state. The college program is designed as a last-dollar-in program. We estimate that 97% of the benefit from this program would flow to households with incomes below $70,000, and that 80% of the benefit would flow to households with incomes below $50,000, and that 35% of the benefit would flow to students of color. The University Transfer Program builds on our success with transfer pathways and creates an incentive for college students to continue directly to upper division work. If fully funded, these two programs would benefit 10,000 students in the upcoming biennium. We're really excited about these programs. We think they're well designed to accomplish several elements of our core mission. A student could effectively complete 3 years of college with free tuition and fee support and advance from an AA or an AS degree to a BA or a BS degree and be 75% done without any cost to that student. Persistence, transfer, and affordability goals are all served by these programs. We're also very excited about the workforce expansion program outlined on slide 27. This focuses on the critical role that you've heard the Chancellor talk about and our presidents talk about that our colleges and universities play in the health of the state's economic life across border to border. Our colleges and universities are the most potent and cost-effective tool the state has to ensure opportunity and economic prosperity for all of our citizens and all of our communities. The proposal focuses on key demand gaps, expands racial, ethnic, and economic diversity in critical fields, and builds pipeline capacity with the K-12 community and our community partners. It includes $15 million for college and university program and service investments designed through dialogue and partnership in each community to respond to that community's shortcomings, shortfalls, no shortcomings in any of our communities. Madam Chair, I would thank you for the attention of the committee, and with your permission, I'd like to turn now to the Chancellor for some closing remarks.
Thank you very much, Ms. King. Chancellor Mahatra.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bernardi, members of the committee. The takeaway from our presentation is simply this. Minnesota State is the answer to Minnesota's challenges. We are ready to work with you to upgrade the technology and to meet these challenges and ensure the success of our students. We are ready to work with you to provide you with highly educated workforce prepared for the jobs in the future. And we are ready to work with you to meet the current and future needs of our students, providing all Minnesotans with access and opportunity they deserve. Thank you all for your time, and we would be happy to respond to any questions.
And thank you very much, Chancellor. We appreciate your how you went through that, how you presented that to us, and now we have some more in-depth questions, starting with Vice Chair Pryor.
Going back to talking about the technology and the next gen, are there similar systems that you've looked at that other states have used and the products that are out there right now? Because I think at the beginning you said what you're using right now was a homegrown, and is this a shift where it's not going to be, it's sourced from something that's similar right now.
So, Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Pryor, with your indulgence, I may ask Vice Chancellor Padilla to come to the table and answer the question.
Welcome back, Mr. Padilla.
Thank you. Thank you. The answer to the question is that we fully intend to buy a product that's already made. Mm-hmm. We are not going to write this software ourselves again. 20 years ago, that was something that our organizations did. Enterprises today do not write their own software. Mm-hmm. So we plan on using commercially available software as a service, in fact. We do not want to host it or maintain it ourselves. We want to buy a subscription service similar to Amazon or Netflix. Mm-hmm. And so that's our goal.
Mm-hmm. And if I may ask a follow-up
yes.
question?
Go ahead, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. The follow-up question also mm-hmm. is, at the tip of the pyramid, you're talking about the students being able to use it. Will this be something where they can assist them in transferring credits and understanding how credits transfer and that kind of information for them?
Absolutely. I think that the best way to describe this is it will be a 100% change in how we currently deliver these kinds of services to our students. Imagine a student in 2019 right now who's grown up with primarily a cell phone, not a green screen, and they should, when you first come to school, you should be able to look at your phone and decide what classes you want to enroll in. You should be able to pick those classes from your phone. If you happen to be on a wait list, you should be able to select those classes, and when they become available, it should notify you and say, hey, that course in geology has just opened up. Would you like to enroll? You should be able to see your whole course pipeline from beginning to graduation, pay your bills, do all those things that you would normally think you would do from your cell phone. We can't do any of that right now. So from that standpoint, it's just a dramatic difference in what we would want for our students.
Thank you very much. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, actually, the testifier couldn't stay there because I guess my line of questioning is along the same line. But Representative Pryor stole most of my thunder, but my concerns were, I think, along the same lines, and that we in the legislature here in the last several years have been dealing with a couple major technology debacles, and that has been the MNsure rollout and the MNLARS rollout that we're still having to deal with the residual consequences. And that is the direct result of having to write, or not having to, the unfortunate decision made to internally develop code when there are a number of sources available other places. And so you've already answered that question, which was my primary concern of, are you going to use something that's not internally developed? And you did answer that already. So then I guess my second question is in regards to the slide number 12, which is the pyramid, and you have phase 4, which is the student interface of this application you're developing at the very end of the timetable, but then you have a green line that's drawn there. So then am I understanding this graphic correctly that was the 2015 through 2020 has already been funded? That was a previous funding initiative that you received, and that's how you got through that bottommost part of the pyramid.
Madam Chair, if I may?
Yes, Ms. King.
Let me get us back to the pyramid. That's exactly right. What you see here is, with your support last year, we were provided $4 million a year in base resources that we use for the Phase 1 readiness work. All the business process reviews, the drafting of the RFP, all of the we've had over 200 of our campus colleagues involved in discussions about what do we want it to look like? What do we want it to do? That was all part of Phase 1, and it was financed with your help with base funds in the 18-19 budget.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the next question is, obviously, it's very important that we future-proof, and you have that in here in one of the slides somewhere. Yes. So the question I would have is, since you are going to be using a third-party vendor, how logistically do you maintain control of that code, because they may go out of business, right? So what steps are you going to be taking to ensure that you are future-proofing and have access to be able to make further enhancements or develop it as the years go on, if indeed that vendor is no longer around?
Mr. Padilla.
The answer to that is, by buying into software as a service, for starters, you future-proof your investment by the fact that we are not going to be the only higher education system buying into a product like this. And the companies that are in this space are very large organizations that have been around for a very long time. And so it's not just Minnesota State. It's thousands of other colleges and universities that are participating in the software that, as a group, are pushing the company to make enhancements as the higher education space changes. So they're not just responding just to Minnesota State. They're responding to higher education changes in general. And so with that, that's the future proofing of it. From a going out of business standpoint, we will ensure that the data is ours, and always will be ours, and so we can always retain that. Because of that, we could move to another platform. I wouldn't say that would be easy, but it would be possible to do that and transfer the information that we have.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the continued indulgence. So then, as part of the testimony, and this is my last question, as part of the testimony, you had mentioned that the transition or the deployment then of the student interface, the last part of the triangle there, if you could just elaborate or maybe give an overview of how you plan to do that. Are you going to start with, or do you even have a plan at this point? Because you're going to need two systems running in parallel for a period of time there, and do you have select campuses you're going to be rolling it out to, and how's that going to work? And then before I give up the microphone, Madam Chair, because this great group wasn't here when we went around with our personal stories, I just wanted to give a kudos to several of the colleges I had been to, and I wrote it down here. So for there's presidents here that weren't here earlier. So during the course of either myself and my wife's academic career, we took courses at Anoka Ramsey, Century Community College, North Hennepin, Hennepin Tech, MCTC, and Metro State at least, and there might have been a few more. But you do great work, and it's, yeah.
Well, if you want to get into that, I think our family topped that more, but we're not going to get into that. No, just kidding. I can tell that people are very proud of Minnesota State and the education that they've gotten and as far as we've gotten to in our family. So I have a next person is Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the $169 million in campus support request, are you going to be able to freeze tuition then or prevent any tuition increases for the next 2 years of the biennium?
Ms. King.
Madam Chair, Representative, what the board is committed to is if the $246 million request is fully funded, the board would commit to not raising undergraduate tuition at all. The commitment relates to the entire request rather than just the $169.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that, but the remainder of the request, aside from the $169, is for other purposes, not direct campus support. So I guess that's, in my mind at least, kind of an imbalance as far as where the money would be going and just how that would break down.
Ms. King.
Madam Chair, Representative, we would expect that all of the money that's in the request, except the technology support, would go out to the campuses for program and service delivery. It just would go out in three different ways, but it would all go into the allocation framework and be distributed to the campuses for investment. The technology request would stay here and be used to deliver the next-gen product, which all of the campuses use and all of our employees and faculty use. So we view the whole thing as a campus benefit request. It just gets there on a couple of different roads.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't quite connect the dots because there are two new programs that would be set up. So regardless of these two new programs being set up, I don't know how tuition at the other campuses would have to go up if the campus support was fully funded. So you can comment on that, or we can talk offline. I do have a couple other more points, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. King, would you like to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, and I appreciate your question. I do. I just am sort of repeating myself, and I apologize for that. But we view everything in the request as a necessary condition for our colleges and universities to be successful. And because their revenue profile is simply state support and tuition, then we just have those two levers to work with.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of feel like I'm repeating myself here, too, so I'll just move on and we can keep talking as the session goes on. I just have one other comment and then another question, and again, we can talk about the question offline, too. But my comment is taking a look at some of the faculty numbers versus some of the administration numbers. And between 12 and 17, we see a cut in system-wide faculty of 2.1%. An increase in system-wide administration of a tenth of a percent. Now, that's fairly flat, but it's still an increase, not a decrease. And so my comment would be I would just hope that you could take a look at if you have to make those cuts, you spare the people delivering the product of education. When those cuts happen, it's long-term detrimental to the departments, to the campuses, to the communities. Campuses aren't necessarily able to start up those programs again. Students either have to change programs or they have to do something else. So, you know, whatever we can do to help out on that, I certainly want to be a part of that, but that's just something I think we need to be aware of. And then also, this is my last question again. We can talk offline about this, but taking a look at some of the campus programs between the colleges and the universities, it looks like the colleges actually went down in program numbers between 6 and 17, 18, while the university programs went up. So as we're taking a look at some workforce issues, you know, I just kind of would ask how you're looking to improve the college programs, how you would reach out to the private sector, maybe get some dialogue going there and just seeing what we can do. Because I hear from M-State up there, there's a couple programs where people in the community are really wondering what's going on, and I know they have to make internal decisions based on numbers, but
right.
If there's anything we can do to get those workforce-focused, workforce-centered programs, you know, as healthy as possible, that's, I think, something else we need to do. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Lee, and I really appreciate that comment. Your careful reading of the information helps illustrate just what a balancing act our colleges and universities have faced over these last 10 years. It's absolutely true that the faculty numbers have gone down, mostly in the colleges. The colleges are mostly where the enrollment has been very volatile. If you look at the enrollment charts, you'll see that, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but of the 20 or 18% increase in enrollment over the term, I think the college increase was two or three times the rate of increase in the universities. So I would expect to see as programs are added, faculty are added, as enrollment declines, then faculty decline. It is the case that our workforce request in the package that you have in front of you is directed right at the observation you make about M-State. There is interest in program design and new program offerings. One of the things that you see in the academic program review report in your data book is our campuses are they're very experienced at program review, talking to their communities, adding programs where there's demand, and if they're faced with balancing their budgets, then that means another program somewhere else with declining enrollment or low enrollment has to be closed. So they have just a few things they can pull in order to continue serving their communities. But I appreciate what you're saying, and we'll take a look at it. One thing I would just observe with the committee for your benefit, one of the things we pay attention to is a national data set where all the public colleges and universities submit all of their spending,
categorized the same way so that we can see how we're doing on a national basis? And one of the places we pay a lot of attention to is how are we looking on our administrative spending, because we're concerned about that. We want to make sure that as many dollars as possible are getting out to the campuses and out to the classrooms. And overall, our colleges and universities and the system office combined, we spend less per student on administration than, I got to say this right, we're 41st in the country on spending on administration in a pool that has 50 measures in it. So that says to us that in some respects we're maybe at risk because we don't have the right compliance staff, we don't have the right attention to non-instructional purposes. But we pay attention to it, and we've worked hard with a variety of strategies that the Chancellor has led around efficiency and effectiveness to make sure the enterprise is being as smart as it can in order to protect resources to the campuses.
Thank you. And we have three members with questions. It's Representative Quam, Nornes, and Runbeck, and we have about 5 minutes to ask the
Thank
questions
you, Madam
and get
Chair.
The answers. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I glanced at the data book. Representative Lean, you might want to look at Section C, page 4, where the faculty between 12 and 17 decreased by 13.2% and the staff decreased by 5.5%. I think there's some additional detail that might be available there. Glancing through, because of the HEPA and that, I noticed that in Section D, page 12, there was a room utilization was 48% and seat fill was 45%, and that's a three-year running. I think that we can look at the details and the surrounding pages for the different sites when we're comparing the HEPA. Section 8, pages 25 and 26, there's some comparison. Minnesota's below the national average, but when you look at the states around us, sometimes there's some priority calls because Wisconsin for community and technical college is spending three times the money that we are, but when you go to the university, you know, the higher level, they're actually spending only two-thirds of what we are. So, you know, members, that might be something to look at for what are our priorities. And in that same section, page 1, instruction is 46% of expenditures. Some data to look at. When you get into the next gen, some of the questions I had is there was a reference to cost savings. It'd be interesting to see what the you break it out by energy cost savings, productivity enhancements, and then lower repair and maintenance costs because you had the internal and staffing, etc. Did you have any data that would represent by year and when it would kick in with your plan?
Okay, and Ms. King, could you respond to that? And then we're going to, I don't know if Representative Quam has
they,
more.
They can do that offline.
Okay.
I also wanted, I noticed that you've completed the initial readiness assessment, and any of that that might be shared with the committee would probably help us to analyze the activities. And then if you had any breakout of, you know, the hardware, you're looking at scalability, percent that is cloud-based, minute involvement, and some of the other details, because we have had large-scale issues with the other ones, and I've got a few others, so I might try to talk with you offline.
Okay, and we're going to go to Representative Nornes for the next question to
Chair,
fill in.
I think everything I was going to talk about has been covered already, so pass.
Okay, thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. This is my first time on higher ed. What are you spending, generally, would you say, on remedial kinds of education? I think you call it something else, but
developmental education.
Okay. What does that run?
Chancellor.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Runbeck. I don't have that number on top of my head, but we'll be more than glad to get it to you. We have it, but I don't want to just give you an incorrect number. So we can provide you with that number.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It looks like I have a minute left.
Oh, yeah, you do.
So When you're talking about next gen, and it's describing the things it will do, it talks about credit transfer. And as I'm just, you know, you catch in talk conversation, and credit transfer is still an issue. So will that system have to link with other systems like the U, and how will that?
Ms. Camp.
Exactly?
Madam Chair, Representative Rumbach, it's interesting you should ask that, because just today I was looking at some work product out of the group that's identified procedures that we're going to have to focus on, and this is one. Because it's a very high priority for us that we make it as invisible and transparent as possible for a student, and we would expect this system to do that. We would expect it to be, if it's even visible, we would expect it to be as easy as possible.
And, Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. So we have a lot of private colleges in the state. Is it going to work? If people want to transfer to a private college.
Ms. King.
Madam Chair and Representative Rumbach, yes, I would expect it to work from a reporting and visibility and student service standpoint. I don't imagine that we would link technically to other systems, but I imagine that our data would be available and transparent.
Okay, Chancellor Malhotra.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Runbeck, the only thing I would add to that is that for institutions which are outside our system, the extent to which they accept credits is really their decision. But as Vice Chancellor King pointed out, we will have the information technologically available to them, which will explain what the students have done, what learning outcomes they have accomplished, what competencies they have acquired, and then they can match it to their curricular designs, because we have no control over their curricular designs. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you very
much. And Chancellor, do you have any closing remarks before we adjourn?
Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for telling our story today, and we look forward as the session progresses to continue to work with you and to help you understand our request even better. Okay. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you all for being here today, and the meeting is adjourned.